This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 23rd of June, these are our main stories. At an emergency UN Security Council session called after the US strikes on Iran, the UN chief warns against a cycle of retaliation in the Middle East. The UN's nuclear watchdog says it can't assess the damage caused by the American attacks, contradicting the Trump administration's claim that its operation was an incredible success. 20 people are reported to have been killed in a suicide bombing in a church in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Also in this podcast,
this person who inspired me all these years, he is my personal hero. Though thousands of heroes are behind bars and hundreds of thousands continue to fight for our people.
An emotional family reunion for a Belarusian dissident released from prison after 5 years. It was an emergency meeting called to try to restore a degree of calm after the US strikes on Iran's nuclear sites. But perhaps predictably, the UN Security Council session merely exposed divisions, with Iran's allies, Russia and China, condemning the American attack and, along with Pakistan, putting forward a draft resolution calling for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, a move likely to be vetoed by the US. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, warned that the fighting needed to stop and negotiations needed to resume. Otherwise, there was a risk of descending into what he called a rat hole of retaliation after retaliation.
We face a stark choice. One path leads to wider war, deeper human suffering, and serious damage to the international order. The other leads to de-escalation, diplomacy, and dialogue. We know which path is right.
The UN nuclear watchdog chief, Rafael Grossi, told the Security Council that while craters were visible at Iran's enrichment plant buried into a mountain at Fordo, no one, including the IAEA, is in a position to assess the underground damage, contradicting Donald Trump's claim to have obliterated the nuclear site there. The Russian ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, likened the US actions to those in Iraq more than 20 years ago.
I imagine that many are getting a nagging sense of deja vu today. Let me remind you that back in 2003, in this very chamber, the US Secretary of State, Colin Powell, waved around a test tube, justifying Washington's plans to invade the territory of another sovereign state, only to waged decades of chaos onto its people to not find any WMDs there. Today's situation is no different in substance to the one we saw in 2003. Again, we're being asked to believe the US's fairy tales to once again inflict suffering on millions of people living in the Middle East.
But the US envoy to the UN, Dorothy Scheer, said it was a different situation now.
For decades, Iran has been responsible for misery and countless deaths across the Middle East. Iran's government and its proxies have also killed numerous Americans, including American service members in Iraq and Afghanistan. In recent weeks, Iranian officials have intensified their hostile bluster and rhetoric. Iran has long obfuscated its nuclear weapons program and stonewalled good faith efforts in recent negotiations. Madam President, the time finally came for the United States, in the defense of its ally and in the defense of our own citizens and interest, to act decisively.
Our correspondent, Jake Kwon, was watching the Security Council meeting.
The two main keyword has been restraint and diplomacy. This is something that every country that has spoken so far has been calling for, that there is really still a window to come back to the negotiation table. It's not too late to take an off-ramp here. And this has been the message from the Secretary General, who had urged diplomacy. And what we've seen is this fault line happening along the more traditional Western nations as opposed to the Eastern Hemisphere. The Russians have strongly condemned American actions, and China had echoed that line that they are strongly condemning U.S. attack on Iran. However, the Western countries like U.K. had said that they support this idea of Iran not having the nuclear weapon, and then they urged Iran to stop itself from any kind of retaliation and to really come back to the negotiation table, which has been echoed by other Western nations. And another thing was the American representative echoed the same line that we heard from President Trump as well as his cabinet, saying that this attack was really out of necessity, that their goal always has been to keep nuclear weapon out of Iranian hands.
We heard from Donald Trump that the U.S. strikes had obliterated the nuclear sites, but at this emergency session of the UN Security Council, the UN nuclear watchdog chief, Rafael Grossi, says no one is really in a position to assess the damage at Fordo in particular, which has a site deep underground.
That discrepancy was already evident in the American side in Washington when Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth was giving the press conference today alongside the chief of staff of the military, who said that the damage assessment is still going on. And this is already hours after President Trump has declared that the nuclear site has been obliterated. How do you square that with the idea that the actual damage to this nuclear site is still uncertain? And we heard this being confirmed by IAEA, the United Nations watchdog on nuclear, Director Grossi, saying that, yes, it's going to take more verification effort on the ground, actually. And what he was urging was that each party, Israel needs to stop bombing, Iran needs to stop bombing, for IAEA ground team to go in there and really do some fact-finding, and that there is a further risk of nuclear material, radioactivity leaking into the environment and really having a human cost.
Jake Kwon. Well, a surprise overnight U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear sites, named Operation Midnight Hammer, involved 125 military aircraft, including seven B-2 stealth bombers, the only planes capable of delivering the bunker buster bombs designed for targets deep underground. Three nuclear facilities were hit: Natanz, Isfahan and Fordo. At a news conference, the U.S. Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, called the operation an incredible success, saying that the strikes did not target Iranian troops or civilians, and that the aim was not to topple the Iranian government, but to stop it getting a nuclear bomb.
This mission was not and has not been about regime change. The president authorized a precision operation to neutralize the threats to our national interests posed by the Iranian nuclear program and the collective self-defense of our troops and our ally Israel.
At the same news conference, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, said battle damage assessment was still continuing. With more details, here's our security analyst, Gordon Carrera.
Operation Midnight Hammer started with deception. A group of B-2 bombers headed out from the U.S., with some going towards the Pacific as a decoy. Meanwhile, seven of the bombers headed quietly east with minimal communications, refueling on the way. They then linked up with escort and support aircraft. Just before they entered Iranian airspace, a U.S. submarine launched more than two dozen cruise missiles at targets at a site at Isfahan. The B-2s then hit two more targets. About 75 precision-guided munitions were deployed, including 14 of the massive ordnance penetrators, so-called bunker busters. They were used operationally for the first time. U.S. officials say Iranian defences did not engage the aircraft as they came or left and may not have seen them. General Dan Kane, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave this assessment.
Final battle damage will take some time, but initial battle damage assessments indicate that all three sites sustained extremely severe damage and destruction.
Satellite imagery shows impact points at Fordo, but it does not reveal what happened underground, and the site appears damaged but not destroyed. Iranian officials have also claimed they already moved their enriched uranium to other sites.
Gordon Carrera. Well, I spoke to the defence analyst, Jonathan Marcus, and asked him what we knew about how much damage the US strikes had caused.
Obviously, the Americans are talking about a very fair degree of success. If you, of course, listen to the political echelon in the United States, Mr. Trump and Mr. Hegseth, it was an overwhelming success, mission accomplished, as it were. We just don't know yet. And inevitably, that will take time. and America's ability to actually assess the damage may be limited to some extent, given that this is a subterranean target. But when you think that they used 14 of these massive ordnance penetrator bombs, which can bury deep down into the ground before exploding, and you know, the impact of such an explosion is a bit like a very small earthquake in some ways. So one can expect there was considerable damage. Whether these had been completely destroyed, these targets, or not, we're waiting to find out.
And the big question is, how will Iran respond?
Well, there's an even bigger question. How much of Iran's nuclear program is left? I mean, where is the highly enriched uranium that was being stored at Esfahan? We don't know where that is. We don't know if there are other secret Iranian clandestine facilities that the West doesn't know about. But you're right, in terms of what happens next, Iran's response is the key. The Americans have signaled very strongly this is a one-off attack. Having said that, though, the war looks as though it's going to continue. The air war, the Israelis are not letting up. The Iranians are not letting up in responding to Israel by firing back missiles at Israeli territory. So as yet, it's very, very uncertain, very dangerous, but a lot is going to hinge upon what exactly the Iranians decide to do, or perhaps what they decide not to do. This is a regime very much on the ropes, and the danger is they turn a war that is about dismantling their nuclear infrastructure. If they do the wrong thing themselves, they could turn it into a war for the survival of the Iranian regime.
And there is that fear that these US strikes could be counterproductive, because with that uncertainty over where the nuclear material is, the Iranians could now be racing to create a bomb.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how much of their program is left. I think the people have got to be very pragmatic and rational about this. I don't think there was a serious deal in the offing to constrain Iran's program. And the actual fact is that the Iranians have gone way beyond what they need to have a civil nuclear program and able to provide nuclear fuel for a reactor. They are so far beyond that. The particular details of precisely what they've done and when they're going to do it are, in some senses, I'm afraid, rather beside the point. They were on a path towards the capacity to have a nuclear weapon, and that actually, frankly, means that if something wasn't done about it, they could well have pursued a nuclear bomb in pretty short order. And remember, last October, when Israel began taking down their air defences, that was a real warning sign for the Iranians. Their calculus may well have changed significantly over the past few months.
Jonathan Marcus, so what do Iranians themselves make of the US attacks? Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian is monitoring reaction within Iran.
People's reaction is more one of concern and worry that this conflict might escalate. What if Iran retaliates? If Iran retaliates against the U.S. by targeting U.S. bases or by targeting any of the naval aircraft carriers of the U.S. in the region, then the U.S. might respond even in a stronger fashion, as President Trump said. So Iranians are worried about escalation. And I guess it's been a rude awakening for most Iranians, both the hardliners who thought that Iran is stronger than it really was, who overestimated its deterrence power, its strength, and also for the people who were somehow happy thinking that if the U.S. or Israel attacked Iran, that would weaken the regime, realizing that war is not a very selective game, that, you know, it's a big package that comes with a lot of difficulties. So Iranians basically are very confused, and still the conversations are very divisive in terms of whether they're happy about the war or whether, you know, they should expect regime change, or whether they would rather have the regime in power than to see it collapse, which would bring about a collapse of the central government and all kinds of instabilities.
Because if the regime were to collapse, there's no obvious alternative.
There is not. The opposition has really not done a good job of trying to coalesce, of trying to, you know, bring its forces together. The opposition differences among themselves, it's so bitter, even more bitter than their opposition sometimes to the regime itself. There are some voices who claim to represent the majority of Iranians, particularly the monarchist groups. The monarchists are closely aligned with Israel itself. So they have supported Israel's attacks, and they've called on people to rise up amidst these attacks. Obviously, that alienated a lot of Iranians. So they lost their base among many Iranians who were unhappy about this war. So then that leaves the other parts of the opposition inside the country, civil society, political prisoners, who have kind of taken a balanced stance, but they have no really little voice because they don't have the media or the access to the population.
And the Iranian foreign minister is going to Russia for talks with President Putin. Are we expecting much to come out of that?
I don't think we can expect much. There has been some expressions of support inside Russia that, oh, we should do something to help Iran. But it's been really more show than substance. I don't think Russia will come out in favor of Iran, though it would not like to see the situation escalate any further. I don't think we'll see anything beyond that, which just goes to the point that many Iranian critics have always mentioned in the past years, that Iran, the government of Iran, is suffering from what they call strategic loneliness.
Siavash Ardalan. Meanwhile, Israel and Iran have continued firing missiles at each other. Israel said it struck dozens of military targets in Iran, while several Israeli neighborhoods were hit by missiles fired by Tehran. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Ione Wells.
The morning after the US's decision to join Israel's bombing of Iranian nuclear sites, these back and forth missile strikes between Iran and Israel continued. Iran retaliated further, with some missiles making it through Israel's defense system and hitting various different areas around central Israel. There were buildings that were significantly damaged, more people injured, although no further reports of fatalities. Meanwhile, Israel has decided to continue targeting various different military targets in Iran as well. What's interesting is that even though this US intervention has been widely acknowledged as an incredibly significant move and one that has caused damage to Iran's nuclear sites, Israel hasn't acknowledged this as victory or an achievement of its stated target, which is to eradicate Iran's nuclear program. Now, that suggests that Israel still sees this as a long campaign, that it plans to continue striking Iran until it feels it has achieved not just that aim of eradicating its nuclear program, but also severely weakening Iran's ability to strike Israel back. What's less clear is what Iran does next. And there are various different scenarios that people here are discussing. One is whether they continue to retaliate, firing more missiles back towards Israel. A second is whether they decide to divert some of their retaliatory attacks towards US personnel, US military bases in the wider region, potentially then bringing in other nations as well in the surrounding region. The other question is whether they do wait a bit longer or whether they decide to rejoin negotiations, although it is pretty clear from what we're hearing from the Iranian side that they don't feel they want to go back to negotiations for as long as they are under attack from Israel.
Ione Wells. Let's look at some other news now. In Syria, at least 20 people have been killed by a suicide bomber in a church in the capital, Damascus. The government says he was a member of the Islamic State group. The attack is a blow to Syria's leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who has struggled to assert control over a nation that's been devastated and divided by years of civil war and recent sectarian killings. Lina Sinjab is following events from Beirut.
It's a Sunday, so there is a mass at 6 o'clock where Christians in this neighborhood attend to this Marilyas church, which is an Orthodox church. We're told that over 100 have been in the church, men, women and children and elderlies as well, when a man, armed man, broke into the church and started firing at worshippers. And then when people tried to push him out of the church, he blew himself up and detonated an armed belt that he had, you know, killing several people. We're not sure of the number, but many people are saying that there are more than 20 killed so far. This is the first attack since the toppling of Assad regime on Christians, the first attack to happen in Damascus and inside the church, a place of worshipping. We've heard one of the priests there saying that this is going to spread fear among the Christian community. Already the Christians have been attacked by Islamists in the past during the civil war, but for this to happen after the toppling of the regime of Bashar al-Assad with this new government that is saying it wants to have a Syria for all and protect all the minorities, this is already a big blow for Ahmed al-Sharaa's government.
Lina Sinjab. Still to come, scientists stationed in Antarctica receive a royal message.
With the sun shying away from your horizon today, I particularly wanted to send my warmest good wishes to all of those serving at British Antarctic research stations.
A leading Belarusian dissident has described how his own daughter didn't recognise him when he was released from jail. Sergei Tikhanovsky was freed unexpectedly on Saturday, along with 13 other political prisoners, as a US special envoy, Keith Kellogg, visited Belarus's capital, Minsk, and held talks with the country's authoritarian leader, Alexander Lukashenko. Here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
This was an emotional occasion, a reminder, should one be needed, of the suffering endured by political prisoners in Belarus. Sergei Tikhanovsky spent 5 years in solitary confinement. He appeared at a news conference emaciated and clearly distressed as he described the moment he was reunited with his family. My son told my daughter, "This is your father," he said, before bursting into tears and handing the microphone to his wife. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya had taken over leadership of the main Belarusian opposition movement while her husband was in prison.
"This person who inspired me all these years, he is my personal hero, though thousands of heroes are behind bars and hundreds of thousands continue to fight for our people."
It's more than three decades since Alexander Lukashenko took power in Belarus, and despite Saturday's release of Mr. Tikhanovsky and 13 other critics of the Minsk regime, there's no sign he intends to relinquish power anytime soon.
Paul Moss. Cambodia has announced that it's stopping all fuel imports from its neighbour, Thailand. This comes as relations have deteriorated over a tense border dispute which saw a Cambodian soldier killed in a military clash last month. Jason Lee reports.
Thailand may be a far bigger economic power, but Cambodia isn't backing down. The country is the third largest buyer of Thailand's petroleum gas, so it knows this will sting, even at the prospect of hurting itself. The Cambodian Prime Minister, Hun Manet, has said that his country would import fuel and gas from elsewhere to meet its domestic needs, without specifying from where. It's the latest move over a dispute that stems back more than a century ago when the borders between the two countries were drawn by France during its rule of Indochina. The French have now gone, but colonialism has left enduring scars. And those simmering tensions over territory reached boiling point last month when a Cambodian soldier was killed during skirmishes at the border. Hundreds of kilometers west in the Thai capital Bangkok, the crisis then took an unexpected turn when a phone call between Prime Minister Pirutan Sinawat and Cambodia's veteran leader Hun Sen, who relinquished power to his son 2 years ago, was leaked, in which he disparaged a Thai military commander while discussing the clashes. The scandal threatened to topple her government, with critics accusing her of undermining the country's sovereignty. Determined to keep her job, she apologized to the nation, yet protests demanding her resignation continued. But she persuaded her coalition partners to keep supporting her government. For now, she may have won over her colleagues, but it's unclear if she has fully regained the hearts of the Thai people.
Jason Lee. An award-winning documentary which looks at how a Mississippi town is grappling with its history as a slave-trading city is captivating film festival critics. The film, called Natchez, presents competing narratives that form part of a wider ongoing debate in the US over whether to bury what some see as the country's racist past or face up to it. From New York, where the film has just had its world premiere, Tom Brook reports.
On the surface, Natchez in Mississippi looks beautiful, even serene. The town thrives on tourism built on people coming to visit its old mansions. The new documentary called Natchez examines how the town is reckoning with its unsettling past, that it is also a community built on the backs of African-American slaves, a crucial part of its history often omitted from tourist-friendly narratives.
That was their favorite servant. He became the overseer of this house. Mm-hmm.
They taught him to read and write. Those are his actual writings right here.
In the town are residents who think its racist past is best left alone, and others who say it has to be owned to move forwards. The film shows both sides. Director Susanna Herbert collaborated with producer Darcy McKinnon to make the film.
It's very a concentrated version of a lot of the dynamics and conversations that are happening across the country and perhaps across the globe today about what constitutes a true American history.
Natchez is a little blue speck in a sea of red.
Early on, we meet Rev, a preacher and tour guide. He gives visitors the alternative, unvarnished account of the town in which he mentions the indignities perpetrated on African Americans in this community. He doesn't see Americans in general moving towards owning what he views as the country's uncomfortable racist past, but he definitely welcomes this film.
It is a baby step, less than a step, in what has to happen for reconciliation and the true nature of that creed that all men are created equal, endowed with their unalienable rights and freedom and that sort of thing. That's a goal, but that's certainly not where we are.
Natchez had its world premiere here in this New York neighborhood a few days ago at the Tribeca Festival, where it picked up some significant awards, including Best Documentary Feature, and it earned some good reviews. It's a film that tries not to be judgmental, it just presents differing viewpoints. But it certainly shows that some residents in Natchez have been heavily invested in the past.
I'm very much a country girl. I grew up poor. We grew up literally at the end of a dirt road.
A key character in the documentary is Tracy McCartney, a local woman who, with her hoop skirt, resembles the archetypal Southern Belle, who might just have stepped out of the movie classic Gone with the Wind, set in America's South. But as a result of her involvement with the documentary, Tracy's view of Natchez has changed. She's grown uncomfortable with what she sees as the racism still evident in the town.
It did make me aware that it's a bigger problem than what I realized. But I think just this film will help, you know, open people's eyes to the struggle that Black people have that I, as a white woman, don't face.
Natchez is a complicated little town.
The filmmaking team is keen to make it plain that they're not trying to demonize Natchez in exploring its southern racist past. It's all part of an effort to further understanding. Producer Darcy McKinnon again.
We're Southerners, and we did not want to make a film that was didactic or that in any way disrupted or kind of gotcha'd anyone. We love Natchez, and we love the South. I live there, and I want to stay there. We want our Southern stories and our Southern places to open up their sense of self and open up and be a place where everyone can thrive.
The documentary is most definitely hitting a resonant chord, coming at a time when Americans are grappling with different narratives of their past, sometimes choosing to embrace the one that looks more enticing and more comforting over one that is perhaps closer to the truth.
That report by Tom Brook. King Charles, a longtime champion of environmental issues, has sent a personal message of support to British scientists stationed in Antarctica at a time of year when the winter solstice sees where they are plunged into complete darkness for 24 hours. Each year, the BBC World Service broadcasts a midwinter message to the team working at the British Antarctic Survey. It's now in its 70th year, and this year the King warmly praised the team's resilience and commitment to scientific research. Our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph, has been talking to the team in the Antarctic.
Hello, Shackleton. This is the BBC.
This was 1956. And the closest we could get to the first broadcast to the British Antarctic Survey.
Are you receiving me? Over.
The history of annual messages from before 2005 has sadly been wiped from the archive.
Receiving you loud and clear. Over.
Hello, Ralph. That's splendid.
But the BBC World Service broadcasts have become an important part of the midwinter celebrations in the Antarctic over the past 70 years. The sun is currently below the horizon there. The team is living in freezing temperatures. The nearest hospital is 1,000 miles away. The King acknowledges the scientific challenges and the isolation in his recorded message for the team.
With the sun shying away from your horizon today, I particularly wanted to send my warmest good wishes to all of those serving at British Antarctic research stations this midwinter's day, and above all, to express the greatest admiration for the critically important work you do.
But it's not all hardship.
So we have a whole range of things that we do on midwinter. Traditionally, we start with a bit of a brunch.
Alex Roots is a winter station leader at Rothera Base.
We'll have a large midwinter meal, a broadcast every year, which we'll get some messages from family and friends and hear some tunes that we've picked as a station. And then throughout the week, we have a variety of celebrations to coincide with that midwinter period, including this year, we're going to do a 10K fun run.
A 10K fun run in those conditions? How fun is that?
Ask me when I'm halfway around.
It's an attitude the King pays tribute to, along with his good wishes for all of those at British Antarctic research stations.
I very much appreciate the resilience and commitment to duty you all demonstrate so effectively, and which embody the pioneering spirit that has characterised British polar exploration for generations.
Hello, British Antarctic Survey.
Past messages have come in varied forms.
It's rock and roll and the South Pole in your cosy Antarctic hidey-ho.
There was a song from comedian and musician Bill Bailey in 2017.
Keep rocking at the end of the world. Love you guys.
In 2021, it was something more traditional from Sir David Attenborough.
That's a blackbird in midsummer in Kew Gardens, sending you best wishes for you in the middle of your winter.
And then the cast of the BBC comedy W1A.
I know it's really hard.
They must be thinking, why am I there at this point?
I've no idea.
I'm thinking,
if
why
they are,
there.
I've just got to send them a message to say that it's very important that they are there and that we're very pleased about
it. And also,
it.
I think the main message is they should try and keep warm.
For Alex Roots, each one offers something to the team living through an Antarctic midwinter.
It's that reminder that we are doing something at the cutting edge of science in a really difficult part of the world to operate, and that people back home are thinking of us and give us something that can keep us on that sense of mission and keep driving us to do what we're doing.
It's the first time a monarch has sent this message. What will that mean to the team?
Yeah, I imagine future iterations of Winters will talk in hushed tones about the experience that we've been able to have.
Antarctic winter station leader Alex Roots, ending that report by Daniela Ralph. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was produced by Harry Bly and Arian Kochi. It was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.